everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. The topic today, the U.S. debt crisis in a new recession, or possibly a depression. This is a part of our continuation of Remarkable Minds, conversations with those people who have something that is profoundly important for us to know. My guest is Professor Michael Hudson. You heard him last week on our WBAI and PRN show, and that was a short interview. Today it's the full program. And for all of our WBAI listeners, where I've been for 44 years, and some of our other stations where we're syndicated around the United States, normally I talk about health issues. But what about the people who right now, and the numbers are staggering, cannot even afford to be healthy? How about the tens of millions of Americans and their children who are skipping meals, going to bed hungry, in a country of plenty, in a country with billionaires and massive bailouts to the rich and powerful, but not to those who need it most? So we're going to set aside today's program because I believe this information is essential to our well-being, knowing the problem, but more importantly, knowing solutions. Michael Hudson is one of our nation's finest and most important economists and Wall Street financial analysts. In fact, Dr. Paul Craig Roberts recently called him the world's best economist. He's currently the president of the Institution for the Study of Long-Term Economic Trends. He's also a distinguished research professor of economics, University of Missouri, and a professor of economics at Peking University in China. He also is a research associate at the Levy Economics Institute at Bard College. And he was the chief economic policy advisor for Dennis Kucinich when he was running for the presidential campaign. He's also served as an advisor to the White House, the State Department, Defense Department, at the Hudson Institute, and the United Nations Institute. He is also the author of And Forgive Them Their Debts, Lending, Foreclosure, and Redemption from Bronze Age Finance to the Jubilee Year, which goes into a history of interest-bearing debt beginning in early ancient civilizations and how solutions against predatory debt can be found in the past. His website is michael-hudson.com. Nice to have you with us today, Michael.
Well, it's good to be back here, Gary.
Michael, right now, Richard Gale and I have spent months compiling from official figures debt, not just the federal debt, which was for more or less the last 6 years going between $19 to $22 trillion. So when people said, well, we have this much debt, what they left out was corporate debt, and especially amongst the most powerful corporations. And the logic is, if you're a Google, an Apple, if you're Microsoft, if you're Citibank, why would you need to use debt since you're already so powerful and wealthy? And then all the other companies that are existing only because debt. Then you also have to look at all the bankruptcies that have occurred. Major stores, J. Crew, Linen and Things, Circuit City, and now some of the biggest players out there that employ thousands of individuals. So when you collectively look at how many brick-and-mortar stores are closing from Sears and JCPenney's and the number of employees, it's then into the hundreds of thousands. So this does make a difference. And nobody ever talks about the equity partners, the people who created all this mess as far as buying companies that could not survive with such enormous debt loads, meaning profiteering by the investors who put these deals together. And yet companies have been around for over 100 years, many of them, generation after generation after generation, were able to have whole segments of towns and cities work for these companies until these guys came in and bought up interest in them and then loaded them up with debt. And now you have doctor's offices. In fact, one of the biggest things that equity partnerships are doing is they're buying up very profitable doctors' businesses. In fact, in dermatology, which is one of their prime objectives, they buy up the doctor's offices, generally giving anywhere between $3 to $7 million cash. A part of that, 40%, is equity in the new corporation. And then you've got all the dermatologists in one area working for the same corporate interest, and then they start pushing very expensive programs, medical procedures on the public. So one time someone goes in and says, I can't afford this anymore. Why did this cost so much? Hospitals are also in this game as well. Well, it's because there's a group of people who are not medical doctors, never going to treat you for disease, but have total control over who does treat you, and they're making a lot of money, and it just doesn't end. It keeps going up at a time when more Americans cannot afford to be sick. And so this is where we are. Enormous debts, personal debt, car debt, student loan debt, credit card debt, mortgage debt, and none of this is being addressed by the people on either the Democratic or Republican side of the House. No presidential White House has taken this on, not Carter, not Bush, not Obama, not Trump, not Clinton. No one has gotten into their mind, maybe we should help people at the bottom end of this by forgiving this debt. So would you please address, can we forgive the debt? If so, which debt can we forgive? And if we can and it's not happening, why isn't it happening? The forum is yours.
Well, let me begin by your statement that why does industry need so much debt and why would doctors need so much debt? The answer is that industry didn't need debt at all. Sears, although it just went bankrupt from debt, didn't need a penny of debt. None of the retail stores that have gone bankrupt needed any money at all. They didn't need money. What happened was that individuals, the predatory private capital firms that you mentioned, borrowed money to buy out these companies and load them down with debt. So the reason that corporate debt has gone up is not because corporations need the debt, given all of their earnings and all the profits they're making. They obviously could do very well, could have paid off all of their debt and been debt-free. But outsiders, financial raiders, corporate raiders, and private capital firms are basically corporate raiders, came in and essentially borrowed money, bought the companies, loaded them down with debt, and then drove them into bankruptcy by essentially looting them, splitting them up and raising the prices. In the case of dermatology offices, for instance, they'd go to a doctor's group and say, wouldn't you like to be millionaires right away? Well, we'll buy out your practice. Here's the money and for you, and you can have the money now. Now, the $6 or $7 million that you mentioned they would pay the doctors, they'd borrow this from their friends at the bank. If you have friends at the bank, if you're a billionaire, then you can borrow all the money you want, and the bank will lend it to you, and it will issue bonds and securities to enable you to go about buying up the whole economy and loading it down the debt. One of the most notorious examples is something that you've had personal contact with, which is Blackstone and the other corporate company, real estate companies, that have bought up the 10 million homes that Obama foreclosed upon after 2008. All these foreclosures were sold, single-family homes mainly, to these large capital firms that bought them out, evicted the tenants. Obama never gave the renters a chance to pay off the debts or to lower the junk mortgages, often fraudulent, to the real value. He made a deal with the large companies, with Geithner's clients, that if he could evict 10 million families, he would make a bonanza for the financial companies to come in, buy up these 10 million homes, raise the rent, say, well, now that you've, they'd go to the families there and say, well, now that you've lost the home, we'll rent it to you at a much higher rate than you've been paying in the mortgage now. So today, more than half of the apartments in all the major cities of the United States, New York, Boston, Chicago, are no longer owner-occupied houses. They're rental housing. So this is important right now, because the question is, when you have a virus attack, which is called an act of God, when you have a pandemic like now leading to huge unemployment and people losing their jobs or being furloughed, how on earth are they going to pay the rents or the mortgages on their property? How are they going to pay student loans? If they're back, if they're behind on the student loan, their salaries can be grabbed. How can they buy food? There is now a whole crisis of not only in the United States but in Europe as to how they can avoid huge amounts of defaults, and how the restaurants, the stores, all the neighborhood shops that are going out of business are unable to pay the rents to the landlords. And the landlords, if they're absentee landlords, are unable to pay the banks. Well, basically, the Trump administration has come in and said, well, we're going to make sure the banks don't lose any money at all. And we're going to make sure that the landlords don't lose any money at all. Somebody has to lose when an economy plunges, as the U.S. economy has done. And Western civilization is very different from everything that went thousands of years in the Near East, the Bronze Age, in the sense that when there's an economic crisis, it's the poor that have to pay. It's labor. It's the workers and it's the farmers. The people who don't have to pay are the people who make the laws and essentially buy control of the politicians, who make sure that they're not going to lose any money. Well, you can see today from the fact that the stock market has soared once again above 25,000 on the Dow Industrial Average. You can see that the corporate sector and the stock market and the financial sector is not going to lose the money. So somebody's going to lose money. Well, if you look at history, you realize how unique a situation is. Think of Hammurabi, for instance. For thousands of years, there were most people had to support themselves on the land. They'd grow their own crops, and during the crop year, nobody had much money. You'd go to a bar and get some ale, and we have all the records. You would sign a tab. It would be marked down on the tab, and you'd have to pay at harvest time. If you needed seeds or plow oxen, or if you needed anything else, you'd run up a debt. If you were a sharecropper or renter, you'd have to pay the rent only when the harvest was in, because nobody had savings back then, just like more than half of Americans today don't have any savings. Well, what would happen when there was a flood or a disease? And you have Hammurabi's laws talking about what happens when people get sick and there's a pandemic. Well, for thousands of years in Babylonia, Assyria, all over the Near East, the debts would be canceled. He'd say, okay, we understand that there's a flood or a disease and you can't pay. So, here's our choice. If either we say, well, you borrowed the money, you're going to owe the debt anyway to your creditor, that means that you're going to become a debt servant to them. You're going to become a bond servant, and you're going to lose the land, and you're not going to be able to pay your taxes anymore, perform your labor duties. Well, obviously, if the rulers of Babylonia and other countries would not have canceled the debts, then you would have had the creditors owning the whole economy, and you would have had most of the population not only unemployed, but in bondage to the creditors. And so they were very clear. They calculated how fast debts grew, and they thought, well, we'd rather save the population, because that's our army, that's our labor force, that's our taxpayers, and not save the financial sector. Well, my book talks about how this happened for thousands of years, and that maintained stability, price stability, employment stability, and it meant that in the Near East, people were retained their freedom. If they did owe debts and had to work them off, new rulers would cancel the debts pretty often. Well, fast forward to today. The debts are not being canceled. So what is going to happen in 3 months when all of a sudden the evictions are allowed to occur again? Landlords are able to evict tenants who haven't paid, including your local restaurants and local stores. banks are allowed to foreclose on mortgage people who haven't paid, and they're eager to foreclose because they can foreclose at a fairly low price, sell the foreclosed apartments or homes to their friends in the financial sector to buy out, and keep on reducing homeownership rates and reducing neighborhood business rates. And the whole economy is getting more and more centralized. So the coronavirus, although it's been bad for most Americans, this is a bonanza for Wall Street. You can see it in the stock market going up. You can see it in the corporate interviews where they say, well, we're not going to lose money because the government has promised that the banks are going to be able to keep the enormous amount of money they've made in the since 2008. The landlords are going to be insured because the government says, well, we have to preserve the banks and the landlords as if they're the economy, not the labor force, not the indebted population, not the students owning debt. And already before the virus hit, more than half of Americans had told the Federal Reserve statisticians that they didn't have any savings. And they could not even raise $400 in crisis. That figure's been reported again and again in the newspapers. Well, if before the crisis they couldn't raise $400, you can imagine what's happening now. If they're unemployed, food prices are going up. Their rents have to be paid. All of a sudden, their debts are soaring, and the only alternative they have, since the banks are not making new loans, is just to keep running everything up on their credit card. I live in a condominium, and everybody who lives in the condominium got a note from the manager saying, we understand that some of you can't pay. If you can't pay, we'll take your credit card number. Just call our office, and we'll just add your monthly carrying charge to the credit card. And of course, if people do borrow from the credit card, then they're not able probably to make the next monthly payment in full, and so their penalty rates are going to go up, the interest rates will go up, and the rates are around 30% now for credit card rates. And this used to be considered usury. Well, the end result of all this is, how can the economy recover if everybody's in debt? If the stores have been bought out and the big retailers have been all bought out and loaded down with debt, if the working population is in debt, the students are in debt, how can anybody buy the goods and services that they produce? Looks to me like there's not going to be much of a recovery if people have to pay the debt. So the choice that the government policymakers have is, either you're going to have a depression and people are going to get poor, or you cancel the debts that have been run up and you say there's an act of God. In other words, something unforeseen, something that is nobody's fault. The term act of God goes back to Hammurabi's laws, when Hammurabi said, if the storm god added floods the fields, the rents are not going to be due. Well, we still have acts of God in the legal contracts that are signed, and the insurance companies have come out and said, well, many restaurants and many small family businesses have suspension of service clauses and act of God, but if they didn't say specifically the coronavirus, then we're not going to pay. Let them sue us. Let them all take 5 years and try to sue us, because if we have to pay people, and actually we're in the insurance business to make money, not to pay the clients, and if they want to get paid, then we're going to go broke, and we don't want that. And so companies that have been paying all these years insurance premiums just in case something forces them to shut down, whether it's an attack or a virus or whatever, are not able to collect on their policies. So you're going to have a whole wave of defaults happening, and the question is, Who's going to be saved? Will it be the financial and real estate sector, the rich, richest people, or will it be the 99%, the labor force? And the Democrats and the Republicans are in agreement, save the financial sector, save the landlords. They're our donor class. Forget the voters. The voters are what Obama called the mob with pitchforks, and what Hillary called the deplorables. They're the ones who are being sacrificed. And as you just said, nobody's talking about this.
I appreciate that overview. Thank you. I'd like for you to go in depth now about the economic implications of debt forgiveness in ancient civilizations going back to the third millennium B.C. in Assyria. Your premise is that ancient rulers understood the value and need for regularly canceling debt, especially debt that cannot be repaid by the borrowers, in order to avoid economic instability. And today we are seeing how our postmodern economy works completely opposite of this principle. In fact, you argue that this was part of Jesus' real message in reference to the Old Testament Jubilee year that forgave outstanding debts. This raises a couple of points that are relevant to what we're experiencing today. So go into this in a little more depth, and also, why is it that no one is talking about debtors' prisons that have come back, where people, and I've interviewed people who had a parking ticket, they couldn't pay $40, and by the time they're then, and they can't pay it, they're unemployed, so then it's compounded, and then they're arrested, and their arrest fees, their jailing fees, even the judge and the probation officer that overseeing it all are paid. They're charged over $125 a day for being incarcerated in a private prison. And in one case, the woman ended up having to get her family to sell a car and some other stuff for $2,000+ to bail her out. What does that say, except that we are returning to a Dixonian era of the poorhouse? Your thoughts?
It's really a contrast in economic philosophy. Something happened in the first millennium B.C. Until Greece and Rome, almost every major city or state was run by a ruler. And the ruler basically thought of, how do I stabilize an economy? Well, what the ruler wanted to be stable was he wanted a steady flow of taxes, mainly in crops, because these were agricultural economies, and he wanted people to serve in the army. And he realized that if he didn't cancel the debts that people had, cultivators had run up to creditors, then all of a sudden the debtor would have to go into the equivalent of debtor's prison to work for the creditor, working off the debt, and also would lose the land. And if the debtor was working for the creditor, then he couldn't work on building the palace walls and the irrigation canals and the roads that they needed. And he couldn't serve in the army, and the country would very quickly be killed. And all this was spilled out in antiquity, and even down to the Byzantine Empire. The rulers said, well, if we don't cancel the debt, there's going to be all this money and power is going to shift to a financial class, and the financial class, an oligarchy, is going to overthrow us. They're going to use this labor to get their own army, and then they're going to overthrow us, and then they'll be in control, and you'll have a secular oligarchy, and we don't want to be overthrown, so we're going to cancel the debt so that everybody can afford to keep paying the taxes. They can afford to work in the army, and they can afford to work in the summer while the crops are growing, building city walls and defensive networks and other public investment. Well, there was sort of a dark age after 1200 BC, and it began to recover around 750 BC, and you had traders go from Syria and Phoenicia into Greece and Rome, and they brought the practice of charging interest to these localities, which were basically a number of classical historians call them mafiosi states. They were local chieftainships, warlords, mafiosi states, and there was no central authority. And so you had Greece and Rome sort of growing up, the rich people, and these, once they had the idea of debt, were able to monopolize all the lands for themselves and impoverish the people. And one after another, they were all overthrown by reformers. The word for these reformers was tyrants. In other words, the tyrants got together, overthrew the rulers, redistributed the lands, canceled the debts, and that was the takeoff of the Greek states, of Athens, of Sparta, and even of Rome. In Rome's case, the other Italian neighbors of it were these little warlord states, and using credit to get clients as people who had to work for them. And so Rome established, it became sort of like the United States was a Statue of Liberty. It said, anybody can immigrate here. We don't have an oligarchy here. We have kings, and the kings are going to make sure there isn't an oligarchy. Well, that worked for a couple of hundred years until 509 BC, when the oligarchs got together and overthrew the last king and made Rome the most right-wing state in the area, and essentially got assassinated. Anyone who said, let's have a government that is a democracy. Let's have a government that protects the debtors. And Rome became essentially run by a creditor class that reduced most of the population to debt, debt bondage, and then conquered other populations and reduced Greece, Asia Minor, and ultimately the whole empire to poverty. And we all know what happened to the Roman Empire. It fell not because of it got sick, not because of Christianity, but basically because everybody ended up a debt slave, living in sexually separated barracks, and the population plunged. Until finally, rivals among the rich families all hired Germans and other barbarians to fight for them, and the fighters who were paid for by these rich Roman families just said, well, why don't we just take over the whole place? And they did, and the Dark Age followed. But what Rome bequeathed to the modern world was this whole idea of contract law, of creditor-oriented law, that a debt is a debt, and you can't cancel the debts. And already in classical Greece, anyone trying to cancel the debt was called a tyrant, their word for a reformer or a populist. And in Rome, anyone threatening to cancel the debts was called seeking kingship. And one after another, I won't go over the names because they're probably not familiar, but year after year, anyone saying write down the debts was assassinated, the most famous being Julius Caesar in 44 BC, who'd proclaimed a bankruptcy law that was pretty mild. It just wrote down the debts of landlords to the so that they only owed the value of their property, not more. And so he was assassinated by the right-wing Senate. And essentially, the Roman spirit of law, that all the debts have to be paid, you cannot write them down, has all been carried through today. Despite the fact that, you know, we call ourselves a Christian civilization, but from around the time of the Persian Empire, Cyrus let the Jews who had been exiled when Babylonia conquered Judea, he let the Jews return to Israel, and these were the wealthy families. Most of the exiled Jews over 100 and 200 years had become acclimatized, married Babylonians, and bought their own property, and just sort of assimilated. But the wealthy families went back to Judea, along bringing a lot of the implements from the temples, and it was at that time that they redacted the Old Testament, the Jewish Bible. They put the Bible together, and they took the Babylonian laws verbatim and put them right in the center of Leviticus in chapter 25, at the center of Mosaic law, that the debts had to be forgiven with a jubilee year every 50 years. And the reason they did that, was put it in the center of religion, is by the 5th and 4th century B.C., the kings weren't like they were in the Bronze Age. They had pretty much backed the oligarchy and the rich classes. And if you look at the Jewish Bible, most of the kings were not very nice. That's what makes the Old Testament so unique. And so the authors of the Jubilee law, that one, you forgive forgive the personal agrarian debts, not the business debts. They were all left in place. You forgive the personal debts. You free the debt bond servants. Anyone who has becomes a servant is let out of jail, as it were, or let out of bondage. And three, any land that they forfeited to the creditors or sold under duress is returned to them. So you have the same kind of stability that you had in Sumer and Babylonia and the Neo-Syrian Empire and the Persian Empire. All of this was brought back to Judea. And the idea was to provide continuity and resilience. Well, we don't know really very much what happened during the 2nd century B.C., but we pick up the story around the time of Jesus and what happened in Judea. And we know this from the Dead Sea Scrolls that have been found, that the Dead Sea Scrolls are basically the Library of Jerusalem that was stored in jars to keep them safe from the Romans who were attacking. We know that wealthy people sort of took over religion, as they tend to in every country, including the West, and you had a rabbinical school saying, "Well, we think that lenders should have the debtors sign away their rights. So if a loan is made, we'll insert a clause." Hillel called it the prose bull, and the clause was, "We waive our rights to have our debts canceled under the Jubilee year." Well, when Jesus got a following, he was a conservative. He said he wanted to retain the Jubilee year, and in the very first sermon that Luke chapter 4 reports, he went to the synagogue in his hometown and opened the scroll of Isaiah, the prophet, who was calling for the Jubilee year, Duror, which was called the year of our Lord, and Jesus said, "I've come to fulfill Judea's promise of the debt cancellation." And the rich people in the town got very angry at them, Luke says, and he said, especially the Pharisees, who were the rabbinical class. And he said the Pharisees loved money, and they said, "Look, this popular movement to cancel the debts that we have is really bad." They went to Rome, and they said, "You've got to put Jesus to death." And they said, "The one word that the Romans hate more than anything else is king." And when anybody in Rome was accused of being a king, that meant doing what kings did, canceling the debts. And so accusing Jesus of kingship, wanting to be king of the Jews, was he wants to cancel the debts of the Jews. And so indeed he was put to death. And that was really his followers maintained this traditional Near Eastern ethic of periodic debt cancellations. But we all know what happened. Christianity was Romanized, or Judaism was Christianized and then Romanized, and once again the oligarchy took over. And so you have the church in the modern world really not talking about debt cancellation any more than the newspapers are talking about the personal debt and the corporate debt that you have. And I think the reason nobody talks about it is cognitive dissonance. I think people are cannot imagine that societies can actually function well if you wipe out student debt, if you say that, well, for the last 3 months, nobody's been employed. We're going to wipe out. Nobody's going to owe rent for the last 3 months. Nobody's going to owe debt service for the last 3 months. There's going to be a debt holiday. People will think that that's impossible, that society would be interrupted. But the fact is, society will be interrupted if you don't write down these debts. So, and obviously, most of the newspapers are going to not try to confuse people by telling them that, yes, of course you can write down the debts. I will say that the Financial Times reviewed my book, And Forgive Them Their Debts, and Martin Wolf cited it as Book of the Year 2 years ago. So the people who actually follow the history and social context of debt realize that, of course, the debts can be canceled. But it's not something that you're going to have any politician back because most of their contributions to run for office come from the financial sector. And, of course, the donor class does not want to back any politician that says, let's give a rent holiday. Let's give a debt holiday. Let's somehow save people from getting further in debt. Let's save people from losing their houses. There's a lot of money to be made in kicking people out of their houses, taking it over, and turning it into rental property. And as long as the economy makes it pays Wall Street to buy up companies and empty them out and loot them and drive them broke, like Sears or the other companies that have been going, J.C. Penney, Hertz, Rent-A-Car, all of these have been bought out by big financial companies and driven bankrupt, and you're having the whole economy all of a sudden pass out of the ownership of the economy into the ownership of maybe 1 or 2% of the population, the billionaires who are all sort of running this Wall Street debt process, and it's impoverishing the economy, and very few people are interested in reading about how debt is impoverishing the economy. They're blaming themselves. A lot of suicide rates are going up in countries that are debt-strapped, like Greece. They're going up here. People who can't pay their debts somehow blame themselves, as if they haven't made it. That's their fault somehow. They don't see that the deck is stacked against them, and that it's a game that they can't win at any more than they can win by going to the casino and hoping that somehow they're going to come out on top. So people have blinders on, and you don't have really any particular group, not the churches, not the universities, no group at all that is trying to say, wait a minute, it doesn't have to be this way.
Thank you for that answer. Today, the debt is being used, in my opinion, as a power to control a population. Not only does it force people to submit to debt peonage, which banks, lenders, and other creditors capitalize off, as you've mentioned, the interest rate, but it also forces people to accumulate more debt. In fact, I'll give you a report that just came out today on how bad it is, where 40% of those who are laid off during the COVID scare are running out of money to buy food. Their only option is then to further use credit cards and acquire more debt. It reminds me of Jerry Mander, who I had on this program years ago, talking about capitalism is essentially amoral. Morals simply are left out of capitalism's equation of acquiring wealth. But banks and corporations have a moral responsibility, but then we're delusional. They don't. Just giving a return to their investors are what they're supposed to do. Now, I want to share something that just I was just given information on today, and that is about what's happening with how bad it is. And it's really bad. 42% of jobs lost during the COVID-19 may not come back. That's according to University of Chicago. Mm-hmm. For every 10 layoffs the economy slowdown has caused to fight the coronavirus, just 3 jobs out of 10 are created, according to the new research. The numbers are finally capturing the full magnitude of the economic downturn. And now the unemployment rate, according to the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics, recently announced a 14.7% official unemployment rate for April. But now into May, it's upwards of 20% based upon the additions. We're closing in on 40 million unemployed just since coronavirus. It does not include all those who were working part-time, underpaid, who had minimal wages before then or not working at all. That would raise it up closer to around 30% easily. So when you look at how many people will not be coming back to work and how many small businesses will be shuttered forever, causing a ghost town in Manhattan and the four other boroughs, then you're looking at something we've never experienced before, at least not that I'm aware of. Certainly when I studied the Great Depression for the Poverty Inc. film, which you were one of the principals to be in that, what we didn't see is unemployment rate higher than 24%, and people at that time actually had savings. Today you don't have savings. So then when you take all this together, how does the present COVID recession compare to the more recent past recessions? There was the recession around 2001 with the collapse of the dot-com bubble and a fall in business outlays and investments. Then the subprime Great Recession started at the end of 2007 that led to the collapse of some of the largest financial institutions like Bear Stearns and Lehman Brothers, and AIG and Fannie Mae. And how is this recession different and perhaps, as we will eventually see, more catastrophic than the other recessions? People eventually return to work, but I'm not optimistic we will witness the same kind of response and return to normal that we've had in the past 20 years. Your thoughts, please.
Well, one of the key for what's going to be different is what you mentioned in the first sentence. You said that debt is used to control the population. Now, this was said very explicitly by Alan Greenspan of the Federal Reserve. He said a couple of decades ago, he said, how do we explain the fact that that although productivity is going way up for American wage earners, why aren't wages going up? And he said, the answer is debt. They're insecure. They're afraid to go on strike, and they're afraid even to complain about the job. Because if they complain about the job and they're fired, or if they go on strike, they're not going to get an income. And if they don't get an income, they can't pay their debts. And if they can't pay their debts, the credit card rates are going to go way up and double. And if they can't pay their debts, they'll be evicted from their homes because they don't have any savings, because we don't pay them enough to have savings. And if they don't pay their debts and they bought a home on mortgage, they'll lose the home. So getting the population in debt is the way that we, and he was a lobbyist for Wall Street, that we at the Federal Reserve and Wall Street can control the population so it won't go on strike, it won't complain, and it'll be glad just to have a job, just to survive. Now, in that sense, what we're having now isn't really a change. The coronavirus didn't really change the economy, but it was a catalyst for where the economy was going already. Because what you just called the Great Recession, which is what the newspapers cut, really is the Obama Depression. We never recovered from the way in which Obama did not write down the debts. Remember, when he took office, he'd promised, he said, look, there are a lot of junk mortgages that, especially for the black voters and the Hispanic voters, they've been charged much higher interest rates, much higher penalty fees, and the banks have lied and pretended that the loan is much more than the property's worth, and we charge much black and Hispanic buyers have to pay much higher prices in order to get housing because they were locked out of the Roosevelt New Deal, and they were locked out of the post-war gains. So essentially, as soon as he got in, he called the bankers and his donors to the his office, and I tell the whole story in my book, Killing the Host, and he said, don't worry, I'm protecting you against these guys. I'm against mob with pitchforks. And I think he spelled out to them. He said, look, because I'm black, the blacks are not going to protest, even though my policies are going to hit the black voters and the Hispanic voters and the poor voters, the people who vote Democratic. It's going to hit them harder than anyone else. But I'm with you guys, you white guys on Wall Street. I'm paraphrasing there, obviously. But essentially, that was the deal that was made, and it's the deal that is still being made by the Democratic Party. The 10 million families that lost their homes found their homes bought out by the large real estate companies, like Mr. Mnuchin bought in, along with George Soros and some others, bought out Indy Bank and a number of other banks with fraudulent mortgages, and essentially just evicted people illegally. He was supported in all this. The policy was very explicitly racist and anti-black. He was supported by California's Attorney General, who is now being talked about as a Kamala Harris, as a vice presidential candidate. I think that this means there's no chance at all that she could possibly be elected. But Kamala Harris joined forces with Trump's Treasury Secretary Mnuchin, with George Soros, in this policy of essentially kicking people out and essentially wanting to restore what you had in Europe and, in the Dark Ages, feudalism. You don't want people to have their own homes. You want them to owe the rent to the landlords, where they can be evicted for non-payment, giving not only total control to the landlords, but total control to the employers of labor, who say, well, if you don't have a job here, if you complain about the job, you'll be fired and you'll lose your home, you'll lose your place to live. Well, you can see right now what's going to happen with the homeless people in New York. You talked about New York being empty. Well, the richer sections of New York, the Upper East Side, are already pretty emptying out. Tribeca emptied out. Partly this is because they're all bought out by foreigners who are buying properties just to own in New York, speculation, while they live abroad, but also because a lot of the wealthy people in these neighborhoods have moved back to the Hamptons or moved outside of New York. The New York Times had a wonderful chart of phone service to show where the phone service was plunging in the richer neighborhoods, showing that they're emptying out. But now you're going to have people emptying out because it's very hard to get work in New York. And also, as Governor Cuomo's been saying, now that the homeless have only one place to sleep at night, the subways, people are afraid to take the subways because they're afraid of getting sick from the homeless people there. So it's very hard for people even to rely on public transportation in New York City. And there was a funny article over the weekend that said that what saved Los Angeles from getting sicker is they don't have public transportation. Everybody has to have a car there. But in New York, it doesn't help. There's no parking space if you do have a car. So if you're if you live in Queens or Brooklyn or the Bronx and you have to get into Manhattan and you have to take a subway, as Governor Cuomo said, you're risking your life. Who's going to work under these conditions? So indeed, you're going to face economic shrinkage of a degree to which we just haven't seen before. And to most people, that's unthinkable. It is thinkable to the financial sector, and they are working with Trump and also with Pelosi and Schumer and saying, how can we make money off this disaster?
There have been a flurry of bankruptcies recently, besides the many small individual businesses that have gone under as well. But for the larger ones, such as Neiman Marcus and J. Crew that you mentioned, and Barney's and Fairway and Lucky's grocery chains, there's a history of equity partnerships and buyouts in their resumes. Would you speak upon why no one in the news media, especially the financial stations, ever talk about the toxic nature of Bain Capital, Mitt Romney? He, by the way, was responsible, his company, for buying Toys R Us, and it went bankrupt. But all these companies with millions over the last 30 years of employees losing their livelihoods, them frequently carrying the brand and then offshoring it to China and India and other places to have a one-time American-made products now made overseas, and absolutely no effort by any president to bring these jobs back, no effort to create a work environment that people can make a living at, not just a minimum wage. It is never discussed. And finally, this is an ethical question that reflects on the character of American society and culture. We're expected to regard CEOs and executive bankers in high regard as among the brightest and smartest people who should have a role in creating national economic and social policies. Yet these very same people who tanked the system repeatedly and then begged for bailouts and federal handouts are always the first to get resuscitated with no idea of the irony. How come you're helping these major corporations that believe in laissez-faire, they don't believe in socialism, but they're first to ask and demand economic socialism for the largest corporations, but never for the average person? Could you address those two? We have
Nobody would have called ancient Rome socialist, but it was an oligarchy, and the oligarchy used all the money to support itself. Your first question was, why don't we read about this in the newspaper? Why aren't people talking about how these companies that have gone bankrupt have all been bought out by outsiders? The companies didn't go bankrupt by their founders and by doing business the way they have been doing them for 100 years. They were bought out by corporate raiders who raided them, looted them, essentially would try to say, well, we're going to smash you up into parts. We're going to divide you into a real estate part and the store part. We're going to put all the debts in the store part. We're going to keep the real estate for ourselves. You will now have to pay us rent and lease what you used to own, and your expenses are going to go way up. Well, that's been happening for company after company and industry after industry. So now here's the problem. You ask, why can't we bring back labor and industry and make in America the masks that we need, the things that we need to fight the virus? Why can't we rebuild industry here? Well, the reason we can't rebuild industry is right now the last 40 years of financialization since 1980 have made America a high-cost country. How can you make an industry here with labor that has to pay enormous rents to live? The enormous taxes. The corporations don't have to pay taxes. The financial sector doesn't have to pay taxes. As Trump said, landlords don't have to pay any taxes at all, thanks to the accountant laws and the tax laws. But labor has to pay taxes, and industry has to pay taxes, sales taxes. So how on earth can you even afford to bring industry back here, as long as you leave the debts in place? If you leave companies owing what they owe, if you leave the labor force owing as much money as they do on their credit card debt, on their student loans, on their automobile debt, on their mortgage debt, how on earth can they afford to work for less than $50 an hour when other countries are paid maybe $5 an hour or less? There's no way that America can reindustrialize. It's been irreversibly deindustrialized by the financial sector, and the promise was that this was going to make them rich, that, oh, if you produce everything abroad in Asia, then don't worry, you'll lose your job, but you'll be able to buy consumer goods cheaper. You can buy consumer goods cheaper. Oh, sorry, you lost your job. Well, I hope you made a killing on the house. Oh, you bought another house, and now you have to work it off. Well, you lose. There's no way that America can recover without writing down the debt and getting back to the situation it was in 1945, when the private sector emerged from World War II really without debt. It's now built up so much debt that it cannot continue this way.
I appreciate your insights. So at some point, we, the people, must coalesce around a central theme for debt forgiveness, and on all levels, as we've done it repeatedly to tune of tens of trillions of dollars over the decades for corporate America, we must now do it for the average person so people can have a quality of life again, especially since if these current figures I shared today are realistic, we're going to have probably about 25 million Americans who will not have any work at all. And so they're going to be struggling as never before. So we have to, on just humanitarian levels, we have to start caring about those who do not have the capacity at this point in life to help themselves. Michael, thank you very much for being on. I appreciate it.
Well, thanks for having me, Gary.
Professor Michael Hudson, and his latest book is Bronze Age Finance, and Forgive Them Their Debts. And Forgive Them Their Debts. And it's michael-hudson.com. I'm Gary Knoll. Thank you all for listening, and have a nice day.
Mother, mother, there's too many.